Many people can work from anywhere. By some estimates, 35 million people already live as digital nomads, taking their work with them to various destinations for months at a time. These people tend to earn more and to spend more, and they're just getting started. With the advent of remote work, the number of digital nomads, or people that work remotely at least some weeks a year from different destinations, is going to explode. And yes, by nomads, I'm no longer talking about people who live on the road or work alone or never set foot in an office. I'm talking about people that might be working in a large corporation with a team, and maybe they're older and have a family. So what can cities and countries do to attract these people? How can employers appeal to them? How do you even build a culture and, you know, set a winning organization if your people work in this way? And what can you do to become a little more flexible in the way you work? To discuss all this and more, earlier this week, I had a chat with Lauren Razavi, who is the author of Global Natives, which is a new book about how digital nomads will shape the future of work, travel, innovation, and migration. Lauren has lived as a nomad in over 50 countries, working on digital tools and a legal framework to facilitate remote collaboration and the mobility rights of people everywhere. Her work and insights have been featured in the BBC, Time Magazine, NPR, and beyond. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Lauren. In your own words, what do you do and what does a day in the life of Lauren Razavi look like?
So it's a big question. It depends where I am a little bit, because as you said in the intro, I'm working and traveling from a lot of different countries. But my kind of day job at the moment, my main role is as director of special projects at a company called Safety Wing. And there I run a project called Plume. And our goal is to build a country on the internet and unlock global mobility rights for everyone. So we're really looking to challenge the status quo around how global borders work and really looking to develop services akin to current government and citizenship services. So all of the work that I do at the moment is building on 10 years as a digital nomad and working as a remote worker space. I'm really taking it to the next stage of things and looking at how the global systems around us need to change in order to facilitate a world where more people are living like I have as an early adopter this past 10 years. And in terms of my average day, I'm managing teams, I am speaking with governments, I am writing, I am walking, I walk 15,000 steps a day. It's one of my favorite ways to spend time and how I make sure that I'm doing enough thinking to work in these far out areas. And yeah, doing a lot of reading, a lot of listening, just engaging with what's happening in the world.
Excellent. So you mentioned so many things that I want to double click on, but maybe before we dive deeper, let's start with some definitions. I know that a lot of my readers, you know, were thinking, oh, a digital nomad, is that a remote worker? Is that a different thing? Is that the same thing? What is a digital nomad and why should we care about it at this point?
Okay, so digital nomads, quite simply, are people who remote work and travel at the same time. Remote workers can be remote from a company or sort of remote from an office, but they aren't necessarily traveling as they work. That's like the kind of different category of remote worker where digital nomads fall. And some people will be much more sort of location-based in their remote work. And why should people care? I think people should care because once the genie is out of the bottle, or you open the Pandora's box, as it were, around remote work, more people than ever before now have this opportunity to consider whether they want to have the lifestyle of a digital nomad. And that can take different forms. You know, a common misconception when we're talking about nomads, when we're thinking about nomads, is that all of us are constantly traveling all the time. We have no home base and we're just going through 4 different countries every month. But actually, being a digital nomad can take many different forms. So I know a lot of people who actually for 6 months of the year will have a home base, perhaps in Europe or the US. And then for 6 months of the year, when the weather gets bad, will travel perhaps to a series of different countries, or they might actually go and just spend half of their year in a particular other country that they keep returning to. And so nomads are often slow travelers. They're going places for 1 to 3 months at a time. And they're often going back year after year. Whereas I think a lot of the misconceptions are around nomads being very fast travelers, being very transient. Actually, I think nomads represent a hugely interesting area of how the internet has changed our relationship with place. The fact that we can remote work means we can live more global lives, which is exactly what nomads are doing.
So thinking of it from the other extreme, let's say I have an office job that allows me some flexibility and I spend 1 month a year working from somewhere else or 2 months a year or a month twice a year, I'm a digital nomad based on this definition. Yeah. And I'm a relevant, like I'm a relevant part of the audience here and also a relevant part of the policies that you're dealing with and advocating. So let's talk a little bit about those policies. You mentioned like a very interesting concept, you know, mobility rights, which is not something that we normally think about when we think about the rights of individuals. What do these mean? Why are they important?
Okay, so I think one of the most fundamental things to realize is that if you look at the sort of UN Charter of Human Rights, the ability to move within national borders is something that is protected as a human right and is a given that a lot of international law facilitates. But actually, we live in a world today where one's right to move across borders to global mobility is not enshrined in international law and is not protected by an institution like the United Nations. And I think in a world of the internet, in a world of remote work, that is a fundamental problem that we do need to solve. We need to make sure that people's ability to move around the world and across borders is protected and is something that is actually talked about rather than just overlooked. And I think that's especially important when you look at the sort of coming climate disasters. If you look at a lot of very detailed research, we are going to have more and more refugee crises in the future, with people originating from countries that are not particularly used to such crises based on climate disaster. And as that happens, we really need to make sure that those global mobility rights are protected, because some countries are simply going to suffer so much that their citizens need to be able to seek refuge elsewhere. So that's quite a long-winded answer, but this is why I think global mobility rights are very important. I'm personally...
I actually want to refine it even further. So I think when I listen to this answer, I think it seems like there's two topics here. Like one is like general immigration or kind of migration rights, and mobility rights. Where does one begin and one end? Are they completely intertwined? How do you view it?
I think the sort of mobility rights are the, I guess it's like migration as applied to the individual is how I would put it. So I think that when we talk about migration, when we talk about immigration, it tends to be this kind of this faceless conversation. It's like we're not really talking about real humans. It's instead about business interests. It's instead about government policy. It's instead about often inflammatory kind of statements in the media. Instead of actually being about you as an individual, you are born onto this earth, and should you be allowed to move around the world, whether that is because of disaster or war, or whether that is because you actually just want to go and seek a better opportunity to study or to work, or because you fall in love and you want to live across borders. I think that's like fundamentally one of the questions that we need to be asking, because in a world of remote work and the internet, the idea that a person's right to move around the world is defined by the coincidence of their birthplace seems extremely illogical, extremely irrational. And you can understand how we got here when you look at the past, when you look at the sort of previous eras of technology. But now we're here, and today's systems really need to catch up with how we're all living. And so, yeah, I really see it as global mobility rights as a more solutions-based lens on issues of migration and immigration as applied to an individual, which happens far too little in the discourse that we find these days.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting history to all of these things, which is like the future that you describe is more similar to most of human history and even to most modern history than most people assume. But we'll come back to that in a moment. But trying to think of, so far we kind of thought of, okay, why is this good for people or for certain people that want to have that freedom and that can even afford to take advantage of this freedom? But let's try to think of it from the angle of cities and countries, maybe a little more. What's in it for them? Why should countries and cities even try to attract these people? So beyond like the human rights or the rights in general, like what's strictly business, why do I want my city to attract these people? I've heard even in the reactions to this event, like posting it on LinkedIn, some people said, oh, nomads, they don't contribute to the local economy. They don't pay local taxes. Why do we need them here? It's kind of like a bit like the Airbnb / tourist kind of argument. My city or country to open up and do something for nomads. Why should I?
Okay, so the most tangible kind of place to start is that the research shows that digital nomads are spending around $2,000 per month in country on the ground. That might well be in city rather than in country. But depending on which city you're talking about, which kind of city or town that's happening in, that can be a really significant boost to the local economy. So in terms of local spend, nomads are a demographic who can come in and they are spending on things like accommodation, hospitality, transport, leisure activities, and a lot of the things that they spend on can bolster what's available for the local population as well. So I think there is a big benefit to kind of having nomads come in that regard and actually spend in the local economy. So it has this kind of knock-on effect of creating the opportunity for new businesses. So whether that be new hotel or sort of apartment accommodation providers, whether that is cafes, co-working spaces, there's a lot of opportunities for local people to be part of an ecosystem with nomadic visitors. And that can really push things forward, particularly for those second and third tier cities. I'm not suggesting that it's necessarily a good idea for New York to make a very big push to try and get digital nomads in because they're spending $2,000 a month. I think most people listening will realize that that doesn't really add up.
Just standing here with you already cost me more than that here in New York. So I'd say.
Right,
but it's real money and it makes a difference for many cities for sure.
Yeah, and I think it can be a real opportunity for kind of underdog destinations, so smaller second or third tier cities that really want to make a name for themselves and do something different. Something that I talk about quite a bit in the book that I think is interesting from particularly the city perspective is the idea of specialization. So I actually use the city that I was born in and the place where I went to university, a city called Norwich in England, as an example of this, because Norwich is a place of 200,000 people. So it's very small in the global scale of cities. In many places, I'm not even sure it would quite count as a city, but it's a university town.
No, it's a city, Norwich.
It's a university town. It's got lovely old medieval streets. It's got like good hospitality. It's got good kind of shopping. And its USP is that it's a UNESCO city of literature. And so it has an absolutely incredible scene for writing. So something I talk about in the book is how these kind of specializations can really put a city on the global map and can be used to attract digital nomads who are interested in a particular thing. So we've seen this unfold with some places. There are places that are very good at surfing or places that are very good at yoga and meditation, for example. And so people who are nomadic, who have that flexibility to go after their interests, will flock there. But I think it's really interesting to consider these perhaps a little bit more off-kilter propositions, like Nora, a writer, come and explore city marketing there. The brand is a city of stories now, which I think is just lovely. And I want to see more cities doing that, really looking at what they have and being like, okay, come and see us for this particular purpose. And by doing that, you create a scene, which I think is really interesting. And really, really good to just bring people together from all over the world who have these kind of shared interests.
I like the use of USP. And for those not familiar, it's like unique selling proposition or unique sales proposition. One of the big themes in my first book in Rethinking Real Estate is the fact that because location is becoming less rigid than it was, then actual locations are becoming more like consumer products, which both is a little scary for some of them that have just enjoyed just being there and being valuable just because they're there. So maybe like the New York cities of the world. But it's also great news for a lot of other locations because they can now appeal to specific groups and position themselves in all sorts of ways and actually have a shot at attracting people away from New York, away from London, or at least part of the time. So yeah, so I think that that's the right way to look at it. What are some barriers? So beyond the kind of big picture immigration stuff that we all know, countries have borders and passports, and that's an issue in itself. But at the city level, maybe more, or countries enabling people to move to cities, what are some barriers that actually prevent people from exercising their wishes at the moment?
So when you ask that question, do you mean what's preventing cities from doing it, or what's preventing
people
being attracted?
I know that even as a tiny employer, an occasional employer, I know that if my employees suddenly live in a different city, in a different state, that creates all sorts of headaches for me. And sometimes it's technically not even that I can't put them on the payroll unless they're in the same state or unless they fill all sorts of forms. I know that from their perspective also, maybe they're somewhere, but they're not technically allowed to work there. So they're not sure, or they're not allowed to stay long enough. So more of these type of things.
So I guess the thing that I'd like to highlight on this actually is there have been a huge number of countries since June 2020 is when the first one launched, but there are a huge, huge number of countries, I believe it's up to about 80 now, that have launched dedicated digital nomad visas of one kind or another. And what this basically means is that in a kind of situation that you're talking about here, where somebody wants to go to a country for a period of time and work there, and perhaps you as an employer, because they are able to remote work effectively, don't have a problem with this. but you also don't necessarily want a call from Barbados immigration saying this person seems to be illegally working in our country. Mm. These new digital nomad visas are tools that allow people to go and base elsewhere on terms that are very well defined. So as in, you will or you will not become a tax resident. You are entitled to do remote work. You are not entitled to take jobs from local people. There's been some real kind of defining of the space. Mm.
What are some examples of like countries or cities that get it, and what are they doing? What kind of policies specifically do they have they enacted?
On the nomad visa front, those are obviously national kind of policies, which then enable, I guess, on the city level, some other moves to position as a hub of one kind or another. Somebody who actually you should perhaps have on one of these sessions and been doing incredible work on the ground with destinations is a guy called Gonzalo Hall. He started in Madeira, Portuguese island of Madeira, the world's first digital nomad village. And essentially what he did is he used his local contacts, went to Madeira and prepared the whole of Ponta do Sol, which is a sort of small town on the island of Madeira, so that it was ready to receive digital nomads and really take advantage of the fact that there were nomad visas available for people to come. And what that looked like in practice was making sure that there was good free Wi-Fi available widely across that area in the of the island, speaking to local accommodation providers and explaining to them what digital nomads were looking for so that they could offer more flexible contracts for 1 to 3 months rather than only a traditional 12-month contract. And he actually told me, I was in Madeira a few weeks ago, he actually told me that it got as granular as going around to local restaurants and talking to them and explaining that it would be really helpful if they could have vegan and vegetarian dishes on the menu, because when you have these global people coming in, some of them don't eat meat and ask if it's not on the menu, this kind of thing. So I think that we think of it as, what are the big moves? What's the policy that we might spend 6 or 12 months building in order to a city to take advantage of the opportunity? But actually, there are some really simple components there that if you get them right, combined obviously with Madeira's natural beauty and its small town vibe, which I think is very appealing to people, there's just huge potential to be able to put places on the global map that were not there before, that people didn't really know about, that perhaps were hard to discover. Because digital nomads, the digital part of the nomad movement, is very much that we talk online. So there are so many digital nomad communities. There are so many very publicly visible digital nomad who will recommend a place and who will celebrate places that they think are doing things really well. And so, yeah, I think it's start with basics. I think the kind of national policies can like steer things in the right direction, but it really comes down to thinking about the local environment, thinking about what you have to work with, and thinking about just getting some fundamental small things right to start attracting people and making sure they have a good time.
So it sounds from top to bottom, it starts with just allowing people to come in, having the legal framework of, okay, we have a visa that actually allows you to work, that recognizes that you're here, not just as a tourist pretending to do something else, and down to working with real estate developers and also cities, local authorities, to ensure that these people can get the type of accommodation that they need, which is not necessarily a hotel, but also not necessarily a traditional lease, and all the way to those granular things about, yeah, local businesses being even familiar with these people, with their needs, even with their values, so that they're not rude to them or see them as like intruders, and themselves, helping them position themselves in a way that would help them benefit from these visitors. Within there is a whole other topic that I know is of interest to my readers and listeners. You mentioned the shorter leases. What do you see as the broader consequences or impacts of digital nomads and even remote work in general on real estate?
Yeah, so this is an area that I'm super interested in, and I'll have to digress slightly to just tell you the story of in 2020 and 2021, during the European lockdowns, I became a full-time hotel guest at a place called Zoku Amsterdam.
Great place.
KU, yeah, Zoku Amsterdam. Absolutely amazing place, very good friends with everybody there still. But essentially, I worked with them to create a concept called subscription living. And the idea was for a hotel like Zoku. And so for those who don't know, it's an apartment hotel. So you have micro apartments that have a dining table, a kitchenette, a bathroom, a super king double bed, a little living area with a TV and a sofa. You have all of this in the plot of a standard hotel room. And it's absolutely beautifully done. The design is incredible. And then on site, you have these facilities.
We'll give them a little plug. I can share the screen now and just show
Lovely.
That.
Yes, there we go. And then on site, you have a co-working space instead of a lobby. lobby and you have many of the kind of like services that you'd expect from a hotel, but it's essentially like a neighborhood in the building, in a building. And this brand was around way before the pandemic. But when the pandemic hit and when everybody was going into remote work, it became very relevant. So I worked with them to develop a subscription living prospect, a proposition rather, which essentially is the idea of making this space available by the month for people like me, digital nomads, remote workers, rather than just by the night as a hotel. And I really see this as a huge part of the future of certainly nomad housing and nomad accommodation, but actually more broadly, I think that we're going to see more forms of flexible housing like this. So in the proposition that we worked on, Zoku have four locations at the moment. They have Amsterdam, Vienna, Copenhagen, and Paris. And the kind of vision that I had was that in the future, people are not going to be paying their rent on a 12-month contract to one landlord in one city, but instead to a brand like Zoku in order to access flexibly these kind of cookie cutter spaces where they know exactly what to expect in different cities around the world. And I think we'll see a lot of different types of accommodation like this, each with their kind of own flavor, each with certain features that perhaps their target audience are looking for, yoga mats or rice cookers, depending on who your target market is, to come into these spaces. But this is an idea that I'm really fascinated by. And it's certainly something that I was Zoku's first customer for this subscription living proposition when we came up for it. I came up with it rather. And I expect to see like many more providers kind of go in a similar direction now. We're seeing a lot of formerly office spaces rethink and think about whether they can go into residential now. And I think this kind of flexible approach and this idea of providing many services in one building is something that is really going to take off over the next decade. Can have a little shameless plug for a moment. Excellent. If I can have a little shameless plug for a moment, I have a Substack newsletter called Global Natives, the same title as the book. That's globalnatives.substack.com. And I'll actually be publishing an essay on this topic of subscription living this time next week. So if it's something that piques your interest, do check out the newsletter.
Let me plug that as well then while we're here. Why not? So yeah, globalnatives.substack.com. Get out, subscribe. So we spoke about the impact on developers. I know that there's a lot of interest from employers as well. A lot of large companies or even small companies are now both struggling with recruitment in general and struggling to bring people back to the office, or at least bringing people to be near each other wherever they are. Any advice that you have for them based on your insights and adventures?
Yeah, so I think one thing is that now that some companies, Spotify is a good example, I think they were one of the first out of the door with this, that now that some companies are offering work from anywhere policies, i.e. offering their staff, even if they are office-based, the opportunity to go and travel as digital nomads for somewhere between 1 and 3 months per year. Now that's becoming more common in the jobs market, I think it will become quite difficult for companies to attract and retain the best talent unless they are looking at this area, unless they're at least giving a little bit of space for people to think differently about their work and to work more flexibly. So that's thing number one, which I think is really important. Even if you feel like digital nomads are not particularly relevant to your field, to your industry right now, workers aren't necessarily looking to stay in the same industry. So you have to like really pay attention to that wider job market and think.
So there's a defensive aspect here and not just if you don't care about it, you should care about it because your competitors care about it and they're trying to draw.
Absolutely. And I think something that I'll mention, so the company that I work for, Safety Wing, we are 200 people from more than 70 countries around the world. We're an all remote company, so we do not have an office at all. But one of the really common misconceptions, I think, about a company like ours is that we never get together in person. We are having 2 or 3 gatherings per year where we bring together either parts of that 200 strong workforce, or every 12 to 18 months, we actually bring everybody together in the same place, which is a little bit wild and feels like a huge conference or party or something. And we also have budgets available for much smaller kind of groupings of us to come together and work in person on the ground. So I think when I think about, when I think about the future of work in general, it's definitely not a case of everybody just sitting on their laptop and not ever seeing anybody else. I think it's just about being a lot more intentional about what in-person time is accomplishing for you, recognizing when a project is going to benefit from, let's say, a week or 2 weeks or even a month together in person versus working in this more asynchronous and remote way. And I think that has a lot of interesting implications for how companies will use physical space in future. So a space like Zoku, one of their biggest markets now is in fact remote companies like mine, because when we need to bring people together, it's great to know that we can access these spaces where we can just bring people in and it's a soft landing and anything we need is taken care of. And it's very much built for people like us, people who are in that technology or knowledge workspace. And so there are meeting rooms on site that are completely optimized for like creativity in terms of like their design and their architecture. There's plenty of natural light. There's lots of plants around. It all sounds quite superficial, but actually these genuinely do make a huge difference to what you're able to get done in person. So I think in the future, we're going to see companies own less office space, but actually have access to a real kind of diversity of different spaces that suit different teams' needs.
Yeah, I agree. As someone once wrote in a great book, the office of the future is a network. Yeah, and I think it's interesting also the kind of convergence of that value proposition that you just described. It's something between a hotel, an apartment building, an office building, an event space, all mixed into one, but focused around the needs of a specific group of customers and addressing it. I see a question from Anya. I still have a question or two of my own, but since you already started answering it, describing your own work, how do you see other companies building cohesive cultures in a nomad environment? And thank you, Anya, for the question.
Yeah, thank you, Anya. So I think the number one kind of key term here that I have to just keep going on about is intentionality. So I think when you are co-located, when you're physically in a building together all the time, culture is a thing that you expect to just happen, and it does. And it's not always great, as in the culture that exists when you're just pulled together into the same place is not necessarily a culture that anybody's thought about what it should actually be like. It's just what happens when you put people in the same building every day. When you have an all remote company, when you're a digital nomad, you really have to approach all aspects with a lot more intention. For example, at Safety Wing, we have 4 hours of synchronous meetings every week, regular meetings, where our core team of around 50 people get together. Doesn't matter which time zone. For my time zone right now in Southeast Asia, it's like 11 p.m. until 1 a.m. So that's me being a glutton for punishment. But we get together, and that is very intentional from our founders who have all had different companies before. And it's really thinking, okay, it is actually really valuable to get together and to kind of have this synchronous time. And we have different activities that we do within that structure. We have a Monday meeting for orienting on goals and such. We have town halls. We have various kind of things. I'm going to say it wrong, but we have a tradition called dugnad. I believe that's how you say it. But it's this Norwegian idea because our founders are Norwegian. And it's basically like we get together and we're cleaning up all of the company resources, like documentation and such together. And it's fun. And you group off with different people, perhaps people you never work with in the company, just kind of do this activity together. And it comes from this Norwegian tradition of stewardship of your kind of local environment and community. And so I think that you have to like approach building culture with intentionality and be prepared to maybe be a little bit weird and do things that are a little bit off kilter. But there's something very beautiful about doing that, because when you approach it with more intention, it means that you're putting more time and care into actually establishing a culture that people want to be a part of. And I've certainly seen that unfold at Safety Wing.
So speaking of culture, maybe the last topic I want to cover today before I pick up a couple more questions. I know we're already over time, but I think we're enjoying ourselves. So we're not going to go anywhere. And you're staying up late anyway, because you have to work. So it's fine. So in the book, you talk about this phenomenon of digital nomads as a broader cultural shift. What are some other consequences of it beyond just, okay, this is how people work now, or this is what companies should do? What is changing here that we should all be aware of is important?
I think so much of it comes down to global identities. And it's something I talk about in the book, and something that has been my experience, I guess, growing up and navigating the world, is that more and more people are coming from different cultures, having different experiences growing up. So if I use myself as an example, My father is from Iran, refugee from Iran to the UK in the 1980s. My mother is British. I grew up in the UK and the US, and now I live in the Netherlands as my primary home base, and I spend time every year traveling as a digital nomad. And over the last 10 years, I have spent various periods of time as like a full-time kind of digital nomad. All of these kinds of experiences are actually not as unique as you might think. I am a very global person, but actually the number of people who have multiple citizenships or parents from different countries or different cultures has increased hugely in the post-World War
II. That as well, by the way. Yeah.
And so we have these very different kind of global identities, and digital nomads are a very visible grouping of people who are really intentionally deciding to live their lives in a global way. But actually, I think the identity in general is becoming more global. And that's a cultural shift that I see nomads as a symptom of. And that's what I think the world really needs to catch up with, is we can't keep the systems that we've had in the past for this era of both global identity and technological change. We need to make sure that we're actually designing and updating our systems to suit the needs that we have in the world today and to suit the realities of what people's experiences of human existence actually are. And so that's a kind of broader shift that I see. And the thing that makes me really excited to be working a step beyond remote work and digital nomads and actually in this space of what does the future of citizenship look like and what is a country in the internet era.
And getting even a little more philosophical on this topic. So one of my favorite parts, kind of references in the book, you mentioned the lost generation. So the people who grew up during World War I in their roaring and matured into their roaring 20s, exactly 100 years ago. And specifically the expat community in Paris, so Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Gertrude Stein. And we tend to think of nomadism and even expatism as a technologically driven phenomenon, but 100 years ago, it was also really deeply tied to cultural, political, economic changes, like that feeling that, okay, there was this big war, something we couldn't have anticipated, the machines are now in charge, that something deep was changing and that people had that need to be somewhere else or to set their home around other people, not necessarily based on where they came from. How is that? What can the 1920s basically tell us about the 2020s? What are the parallels that you see?
Yeah, so I think one thing that I was actually reflecting on earlier today, so I'm glad this question comes up in this way, is I'm a millennial, and I feel like during our lifetime as millennials, we saw this once in a generation experience several times. So I remember when I was at university, just after the global financial crisis of 2008, 2009, it was described as a once in a generation phenomenon. And now here we are, potentially about to have another one of those.
Once in a five-year phenomenon.
We've lived through a kind of crazy pandemic and that kind of thing going on. And so, yeah, I think this once in a generation kind of thing is an interesting concept, considering that millennials are primarily the group that have driven the nomad. And I do see it as a rejection of kind of older ideals in society. So the idea of pursuing freedom, the idea of things in the world having changed so much that perhaps the previous generation, our parents' generation, don't have the answers that we need. And so we need to go off and search for them ourselves. I definitely see that as a parallel. I also think that when you look at that kind of incredible artistic culture and heritage of the 1920s kind of Paris movement and Paris scene, I think it also just shows what happens when people from different cultures come together and create their own culture. And I think you can definitely see that reflected in the nomad movement today. And even more broadly, just in internet culture. I think the internet has produced more global culture than ever. And that's a really positive thing. We all have these different frames of references, these moments in perhaps internet history that we can all remember. Do you remember where you were when Trump tweeted the, despite all the negative press, Covfefe? Like what? When the internet spent a week trying to figure out what Covfefe was or Covfefe, however you're to say it. We have these moments where certain things have gone viral, where certain things happened. And that is on a much grander scale than it was 100 years ago. But it's the same kind of thing of when you give people ways to connect and communicate in new ways, they create culture together. It was happening without such technological means 100 years ago, physically in Paris. And now, supported by technology, it's happening in many more places. We didn't get to onto specific nomad hubs, but places like Lisbon, Portugal, Chiang Mai, Thailand, Bali, Indonesia, Medellin in Colombia have been these kind of like early nomad hubs where people like me and Peter Levels and Steph Smith were all like spending time and traveling. And now we're all doing our own projects and I guess have been recognized as people who are some public faces of that movement. And yeah, again, it's like people coming together from different cultures and just making stuff. It's real magic, if you ask me.
Yeah, I was building websites out of Chiang Mai in 2001. So it's crazy how long.
Very OG.
It has been. I also think there's another interesting parallel here. The 1920s, I think at the moment, and I described it in positive terms, which I love, that it's not just not necessarily people rejecting where they came from, but people embracing the fact that, yes, there's this whole culture that we're part of that involves other people and has nothing to do with geographical boundaries. And in a way, there's a tension or a mismatch between where we happen to live and the kind of the culture that we belong to. And there's all sorts of laws and obviously just the physical distance itself that limits us from fully exercising our belonging. And I think in the 1920s, there was something similar. Like one of the biggest changes that World War I has wrought was the fact that it even created all of these borders and even the idea of passports and people needing visas. There's the famous, I think, John Maynard Keynes quote from, I think, just after World War I or even during World War I, where he writes, oh, I live here in London and the click of a button or with a phone call or sending a messenger, I can get whatever I want from anywhere in the world and I can get on my car or carriage and drive to another country or take a boat and the world is completely open to me. Obviously, he was quite privileged, but actually the world was open to everyone. People would just go somewhere and they would just live there. They didn't need a visa. They didn't need a passport. They didn't need permission from anyone. And one of the things that World War I did was create that strong mismatch on the one hand between people like the expats in Paris that felt like they're part of something that is global and the fact that now they're not able to really travel as freely as their ideas travel. And I feel like we're getting into a similar period now where the internet is so much ahead of the rules and the boundaries of the world we live in, and we're still figuring out how to make it work. A couple of questions from the audience before we finish. It feels like a bit of a letdown. We got to such high philosophical places and now we have to come back to practical things. But a question from, you touched on it also, even nomadism is a rejection of our parents' generation. And I'm starting to feel that tension as well because I still feel part of that movement, but also I have my own kids now. German or Herman asked, yeah, you tend to think of nomads. Yeah, okay, they're young. They don't have kids. They don't have commitments. They'll grow out of it. Is that a fair description or was it a fair description that is now changing? How does this group define, how is it defined in terms of age and parental obligations?
So certainly the early nomad movement, which I define as between about 2005 and 2015, although you could probably say until 2020, because I think the pandemic was a pretty decent inflection point for changes. It was primarily young people. It was reasonably new, or people who maybe had taken a first job out of university and were not liking it very much and went off in search of something else. So it was primarily young people. Now, however, in the time since the sort of early adopters, the demographic is much broader. So even within my team at Safety Wing, there are a number of people who are full-time nomad families. And I'd say one of the differences is they do travel a bit slower. As in, if you're free-flying, 20-something single nomad might travel somewhere for 1 to 3 months. Perhaps your nomad families are going places for at least...
When I go to the convenience store, I travel slower because I have kids. So that's completely...
There we go.
Getting everyone in the car just takes longer.
Yeah. But yeah, I think nomad families are becoming much more of a thing because there are so many of us who I guess have done this through their 20s. And now we get into our 30s, we think about having a family or whatever, and we don't necessarily want to give up that global lifestyle because we feel globally connected. Not because we want to, as I said before, do fast-paced travel and be super transient, but just because we want to live lives that are global and we can experience new cultures and actually have our next generation, our kids also experience new cultures in that way. So I think it's becoming much more common. I think the extent to which it becomes an easier and more mainstream option to travel as a nomad family largely depends on the infrastructure that is built. I've met a number of people who are working on the future of education for these kinds of nomadic families, and there's some really promising stuff going on. Just recently, when I was in Adira, I came across the founders of Brave Generation Academy, which, if anybody's interested in this area, is a really interesting example of a sort of new generation school. It's essentially a network of schools wherein families can, I love how quick you are with links, Draw. This is great.
Doing my best.
But yeah, essentially, these are very small scale schools, a network where you have a consistent curriculum, but then you're able to go physically to different spaces, depending on where you are in the world. And there are a few different concepts like this kind of coming up that are just making it easier, making it more viable for families to live like this. I think also one of my colleagues, actually our head of culture, Adrian, is often sitting there talking to me and on his laptop, and he's got his kids either side of him on their laptops doing their home education. And I think in a way, it's remote education is going to prepare people to be remote workers in the future. So it's certainly not a case of having to necessarily at this stage of things, make sure that kids are in a conventional school, which likely is not actually teaching them the skills that they're going to need in the workforce. Yeah. So I think really interesting times, but what is possible depends on the infrastructure which is built, which, to plug my own work, is exactly why I'm working on the kinds of things I'm working on at Safety Wing and with the Plumia project, is because we want to make sure that there is infrastructure for more people to be able to access this kind of lifestyle and to be able to be freer in their existence.
So I think that's, I wholeheartedly agree, and between the lines, you can also sense that there's various systems here that need to be revamped. And yeah, so it's education, it's work, it's immigration, it's travel, it's urban planning, it's real estate planning, it's the services we provide. There's plenty of work to do. So those of you who are interested in figuring out what needs to be done and in doing it, do check out Lauren's book. I just finished reading it and enjoyed it. And I think if you've heard Lauren speak now, you understand why. It's just such a joy to listen to, so clear, so interesting. Check out Lauren's book, her website, lraz.io. You can check out my website as well. It's pretty good too. And Lauren, thank you so much for this. I had a great time, and I'm sure everyone else did as well. And I hope to see you soon somewhere warm and exotic, but productive.
Indeed. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. You.